obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Yeah, that's the first Harley I ever rode sounding like a diesel. I'm going to tell you, that thing was banging. And I said, John, don't you think this thing's making a racket? He says, oh, it's just a bearing going out. I pulled up next to him at a red light, and I pulled in the clutch, and he says, God, I heard that thing a half a block back. Anyway, I want to thank the committee, and I ain't going into how many. God knows there's hundreds of y'all. I have been to a lot of pig pickings and candy pullings and all kinds of things, but I ain't never been to a rodeo like this. Y'all don't do nothing little out here. The first night you handed me the schedule, and I went to the room, it was like reading War and Peace. And just one little piece of housekeeping, who was responsible for the gift baskets for the speakers? Where? What were you thinking? I went over to the store last night to get a little bit of junk food. You know how us drunks are. And I spent about $12 on junk, and I came back to the room, and my light on my phone was flashing. So I called the front desk, and they said, you got something down here for you. And I went down there, and they handed me this sack. And the guy says, I believe you're going to need a luggage cart to get this to the room. And I did. It weighed about 50 pounds. But thank you. So if anybody needs any junk, I'm on the 10th floor. Just come see me. You guys do an incredible job. I've been to a lot of roundups, a lot of conferences, but this is the granddaddy of them all. Thank you. You guys know what you're doing. My name is Larry Scott, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm free this afternoon. My sobriety date is December 31st, 1987. And this is going to sound so cliche, but to stand at this podium in this room with so many of my heroes is such an honor. I had cats walking up to me last night that I've only heard their names, and they greeted me like I was somebody. And you guys have treated me like I was somebody, and as Charlie Yao would say, you hugged me like I was somebody. And I'm going to talk about something kind of tough. I need to get this out of the way. Because my best friend, my big book study travel partner, Charlie Yao, stood at this podium last year. And he's responsible for me being here. How many people in the room were here last year to hear Charlie? Well, many of you may not know, we lost Charlie January the 23rd. Yeah. My final conversation with Charlie is he was on his deathbed. He was rubbing my arm. His vocal cords had become paralyzed, and all he could do was whisper. And that big, monstrous, southern teddy bear voice had gone away, and all he could do was whisper. And I said, Charlie, is there anything I can do for you? He said, Larry, boy, you just keep praying. And as he rubbed my arm, he says, I ain't done with you. And my heart to yours, from that moment to this, I audibly hear Charlie Yao's voice in my head. He's standing here with me right now with his big old hand on my shoulder. There'll never be another one like him. And God, I love him. I miss him so much. One little quick story. My crew from the OC are here. They hosted Charlie and I over there a year or two for the Big Book Comes Alive. And this is the one time to California, Charlie and I didn't rent motorcycles. And we were walking everywhere because we had everything we needed. We had a Super Target and fish taco stands on every corner. And we was walking along, and I said, Charlie, what do you want to do now? He said, well, Larry, boy, I believe I want some ice cream. I said, well, I don't know if there's an ice cream stand. He said, we'll just go down here to the Target. And Charlie wasn't fancy. He loved either chocolate or vanilla ice cream. He don't want none of that other stuff. So when we went in, when we go into one of these places, Charlie will go this way and I'll go that way. And he came to the register, and he always came back with them 18-inch long Slim Jims and a roll of Tums. And he had a half a gallon of vanilla ice cream. And I looked at that rig and I said, well, Charlie, have you noticed the size of the freezer in them little old hotel refrigerators? He got that big old grin on his face. He says, I know, Larry boy. Looks like I'm going to have a milkshake for breakfast. Anywho, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I just didn't want to drink no more liquor. I didn't want to hurt no more of God's kids. And if I could have achieved that, I would have surpassed the moon. But what you did on this walk is you taught me what our founders did, and you showed me what they achieved. And you showed me in your own way how you have closely followed their path. And you told me 1,000 times in my first 5 years, if I wanted what you had, I had to do what you did. And I didn't hear that, because for my first 5 years, I hung out on the porch playing grab ass with the girls and smoking cigarettes. And finally, somebody snatched a, I think it was God, snatched a knot in me and brought me to my senses. And a group of guys opened up this book and taught me what was in it. In studying our history, and I'm not an archivist by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm fascinated by the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm fascinated by the early group consciences that they had. I was telling somebody yesterday, hell, if you go to change the brand of coffee in our meeting, there'll be a lynching. You know? And they're talking about books and hospitals and who's going to do this and that. And what I discovered is that Bill Wilson was taken through the steps by Ebby in just a few days, not weeks or months. He did the work in days. Ron stood here last night, very eloquently stated it. I mean, I was sitting at the front table, and he hit me right where I live. 5.5 months, the only thing that had kept Bill sober was intensive work with others. Nobody got sober but him. And when his butt was on fire in Akron, and that business deal went south, all he knew to do was to call and get a hold of another drunk. And I know you saw the movie, My Name is Bill W. He called one preacher that day. He didn't call a whole bunch of people. He didn't go get a handful of nickels. He called Walter Tunks. And the reason he called Tunks is because up northeast, he and Lois would go for a walk out in the woods, and when they'd go for a walk in the northeast, they called it going for a tunk. He thought it was novel. He called the guy, and he just so happened to be a member of the Oxford Group movement. Through a turn of events, he gets a hold of Henrietta. Henrietta puts him in touch with Ann and Bob, and what if on that day, May the 12th of 35, Bill had walked into that gatehouse and Bob said, Mr. Wilson, please help me. I'm dying of alcoholism. I'm dying. Bill says, sorry, dude. I ain't got but 5.5 months. You're going to have to call me next year. You see, I don't know what happens in Southern California, but in my town, you can't sponsor till you got 2 years. You can't stand at a podium till you got a year. You can't chair a meeting until you got a year. I don't know where they get those cockamamie rules. I just don't. It's my opinion. In my study, I found out that not one of the first 100 took more than 30 days to take the work, to do the work. Had a pretty good success rate back in them days, too. So it's December the 31st, 1987, and God intervenes in my life. Wasn't what I thought was going to happen on that day. It was New Year's Eve, but I was rendered sober. I'm going to go back a little ways. As a little boy, I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. My father was a trucker. And in the summertime months, my family would send me to South Georgia, a little town where I was born called Hazelhurst, Georgia. A little sidebar, I get to speak there in about 2 weeks. It's probably going to be the biggest gig I have ever done. Because all them people get to see Larry Scott all shined up. Anyway, I'm serious. That's going to be a big gig for me. They're doing a little anniversary down there. Anyway, my family would shoot me off to Hazelhurst in the summer months to work in the tobacco fields. Well, I was too little to actually get down and crop the tobacco, so my job was to drive the tractors. There began my complete love affair with the internal combustion engine. Boy, and I tell you what, if it's got chrome on it and burns high-test gas and it's loud, I like it all that much more. But they had a Farmall Cub, they had a Ford, and they had a John Deere two-cylinder, 520. Poppin' John, they called it. Well, in the lunchtime hour, when the farmhands, when I feel like I'm under one of them things that keeps the hamburgers warm. Y'all feel that way? I keep turning, hoping I can get an even tan. Anyway, during the lunchtime hour, when the farmhands were in the house eating lunch, my job was to go out this 1,000-gallon tank and pump gasoline into these things. Well, they didn't have automatic cutoffs, so I'd lay up on the hood of these tractors and go to pumping, and I'd listen down for that gas to come up in the fill neck. Well, I discovered that I just love gasoline. They'd come out and find me passed out underneath that pecan tree with a grin on my face. Well, at the end of the summer, I'm a pretty quick study. I love gasoline, and there's an Amoco station 2 blocks down the street. Hell, I went and got me a job. And back then, they didn't have automatic cutoffs on them pumps, so you'd pull the tags down them old Cadillacs and Oldsmobiles and listen for that gas to come up in the fill neck, and it'd find me passed out in the driveway with a grin on my face. Well, as life progressed, I was about 14, and somebody told me if I took a tube of model airplane glue and squirted it into a penny candy sack and breathed it in, I'd get a little buzz. I love glue. Me and 13 other fellers at the age of 12 years old went to jail for sniffing glue. Yeah, they didn't know what to charge us with. They just knew we were having way too much fun. They locked our ass up. Came home, and my daddy's a good old Southern boy, sixth grade education, and he didn't kick my tail for sniffing the glue because he didn't understand that concept. But he beat me raw for stealing that 10-cent tube of glue. Well, I'm about 14, and I got a buddy that's an old motorcycle road dog of mine, and he's still a good friend, but he missed this bullet somehow or another. He drank and used and did all them things I did, but he could just say, I've had plenty. No thanks, I've had enough. I have no idea where that comes from, but Danny and I would scour the alleys down Main Street in Jacksonville, Florida, and we'd go back behind these retail shops where the winos and the... Y'all keep shushing. You want me to shut up? Okay, just saying. I pay attention. Where these winos and alcoholics would discard their bottles. And the first thing we would do is we'd look for a quart bottle, and we'd spin the cap off of it, throw it away, and then we'd pick up other bottles, anything we found. Port, gin, rum, vodka, bourbon, didn't matter. And whatever was left in that bottle, we'd pour the remainder into this quart bottle till we got about that much up in it. And then we'd flip a coin to see who got to drink it. Now, I'm going to tell you something. If you just think about all the stuff I poured in there, you know at this point of the game, I am not discriminating. People say, well, I love a good single malt scotch. I love what Ron said last night, my drink of choice. I like a good box of wine, you know? But it would alternate from that day through the week, and we'd drink, we'd do that. And, you know, I'm a child of the 60s, so you can kind of fill in the blanks there. Going into life a little bit, and in the 1970, I went to work for a rock and roll radio station in Jacksonville. And during these days, and this is not to impress you, just to kind of tell you how I blossomed. In those days, there were a lot of really, really kicking Southern rock and roll bands from that town. And they would come into the radio station for new album promotions or autograph signings or interviews or whatever the case may be. And I got to be good friends with those guys. I'm pretty easy to get along with, especially if you like to dibble the way I like to dibble. And we had this account called The Other Place. Just to kind of give you an idea, this is going to qualify me. And The Other Place was a great big gutted Winn-Dixie food store. Like a, I don't know what y'all's grocery store is at. It was a gutted grocery store. And up on this wall, they had a stage, much like this. And Friday, Saturday night, they'd bring in some known acts. Nantucket, Sleigh Ride, Molly Hatchet, never knew who was going to be there. But during the weeknights, it was a little slow and kind of hard to fill up this grocery store with people that were interested. They don't want to go in here, people spin records. So they ran a promotion on Wednesday night called Sink or Swim. I love Sink or Swim. Because you walk up there, and they'll rubber stamp your hand, and for $15, you can go in there and drink all you can hold all night long. I'm an alcoholic. I'd stop on the way and buy a pint and jacket just to get ready to go drink all I can drink. I mean, it made sense at the time. There's a word in our book over in the doctor's opinion, and the word is grace, and that word means undeserved favor or unmerited mercy. Thank God I didn't get what I deserved, because this part of the story is about God's grace. Like many of you, he's had his shot, and he passed, and I'm with you today. I'm living with a guy named Jimmy, and Jimmy had a biker bar called Fling Nasty Saloon. And it looked just like what you saw in your mind when I said it. The side of it looked like Walt Disney and Peter Max had puked all over the side of it. It was just all Technicolor. Well, inside of it, it was probably 15 by 30 feet long. And when you walked, your feet would stick to the floor. And it had this pool table down at one end that had so much beer spilled on it. When you'd go to break, you'd hit that cue ball and it'd roll about that far and go, just lock up. Well, I was in there one night and this cat walked up to me. I've never seen him before nor since. And he says, "Do you like to fly?" I don't know a damn thing about flying. I said, "You betcha." He said, "Well, I got a little old plane out here at a private airstrip. You want to go?" I said, "I'm in." It's November in Jacksonville, and with that humidity, it's pretty cold. Well, I get in the car with this guy, and I had that moment of clarity. All that stuff started wearing off a little bit, and I thought, you don't even know this guy's name. He may not even have a driver's license, much less a ticket to fly a plane. But the cowboy in me said, "Shut up, Larry. It's going to be fine. Let's go." So me and the cowboy jumped in the car, and we're heading out to this little airstrip. We get there, and it's a grass runway. And there's a little old trailer house off in the distance with these aircraft lined up. He says, "You wait right here. I'll be right back, and I'll leave the car running so you don't get cold." And I said, "All right, good deal." The same guy says, "You need to back out of this deal right now." And cowboy says, "Shut up. It's going to be fine." Well, he came out of that little trailer house, and he waved, and I waved, and he jumped in this plane. The light came on, and nothing else happened. He got out, and he went back in the trailer house. He came back out. He waved, and I waved, and he jumped in another plane. Light came on in that plane, and nothing else happened. I'm a pretty quick study. We're stealing an airplane. Not only are we stealing an aircraft, I don't even know if this guy knows how to crank it. Third attempt, he comes out, jumps in the plane, light comes on, and it spits and belches a little bit of smoke, and he waves, and the same part of me said, "Just say no." Cowboy said, "Shut up and get in the plane." So I get in the plane, and he hands me a headset, and he goes, "Where do you want to go?" I said, dude, you're driving. He said, well, let's go buzz the bar. I forgot to tell you, the bar was a biker bar, and the hippies like to hang out there, and the hippies always had the stuff the bikers liked. Wasn't a real, real good chemistry. A little bloodshed over that stuff. So somehow or another, he gets the bar on this headset, and he tells them, we're coming. Well, as the crow flies, it's about a 10-minute run. So we start dropping altitude, and this place, Fling Nasties, is an area much like where we're at right now. This is not a rural area. And all of a sudden, it starts dropping, and he leans this baby over on that left wing, and I'm looking out his window, and sure enough, there's the bikers and the hippies in the parking lot waving. And he buzzed right over the top of them phone lines, and I said, phew. That went pretty good. And we fly a little bit further east, and all of a sudden, he starts dropping altitude again. And there's a river that runs through the west side of Jacksonville called the Temecula River. Not a very big river. And the waterways in Jacksonville are governed by the tides. Well, hell, when I left home that night, I didn't go check the tides. You know, I didn't know I was going to get in an airplane with a yahoo. So anyway, he starts dropping altitude, and we get right over that river. And I look through the windshield, and here comes the Ortega Bridge. And it's not a square opening like this. It's one of these half-moon-shaped openings. And I'm a pretty quick study. I'm not a physicist. I'm not very good at math. And I looked at the wings. And I looked at the opening, and I said, we're going to need some Vaseline to get through this opening. All right, I've done some pretty stupid things. I know y'all probably can't relate to that. I left the radio station and went to work for a management company for Lynyrd Skynyrd Band called Sir Productions, a guy by the name of Peter Rudge out of New York. And I'm living with Leon Wilkerson, the bass player. And we're on the road. And y'all are out here from Hollywood. Y'all know all about the crazy business. Well, if you take what you've read or heard about Skynyrd and multiply it by about 50, you got a little bit closer estimation of what the insanity of the road was really like. And Leon was the nut job that ran the whole deal. And the last few tours, we called them torture tours because we did 59 dates in 61 days. That's pretty easy to figure out. But the insanity of the road, we were in New York City, and Ronnie slammed a steel hotel door on Gary Rossington's fret fingers. We're doing three nights at the Beacon with the Outlaws and 38 Special. And, I mean, he's got no regard. Thank God we were able to bring in some other guitar players, blah, blah, blah. The insanity of the road was getting to me. And so I contacted the label MCA, and I said, I want to get off the road with these guys. It's nuts. So I was to meet with an executive out of Miami at an autograph signing party one morning as we were out promoting the album Street Survivors. It had just hit. And as always, I got into an argument with this guy. And I said, to hell with you, I'm not getting on the plane. A friend of mine came and picked me up and took me back to Jacksonville, and that evening as we were doing what we do, the phone call came that the Freebird had fallen into the swamps in Macomb, Mississippi. Just a few minutes later, we found that Ronnie, Cassie, Steve, Dean Kilpatrick, and the pilots had all died. For years, I'd walk around, and I'd tell you, what a lucky break. I didn't get on that plane. What a coincidence. No, you've taught me better than that. It's called God's grace. I wasn't supposed to be on that plane that day. Now, something that you may or may not know, the band was taking a shot at getting sober at that very point in time. I have a People magazine back home. It shows a picture of Ronnie on the cover holding his new baby girl with his wife Judy in an old Mercedes that he had bought that he was restoring. shows pictures inside of him lifting weights and his health regime. He was trying to turn his life around. When you listen to the song, That Smell, it's not about getting loaded. That's about getting sober. About 3 years ago, a dear friend of mine over in Louisiana called me, a taper, and he asked me if I would come and share at the Fourth Dimension Conference in Macomb, Mississippi. And I said, James, I can't say yes to that right now. And I said, I'll get back with you. And I called my sponsor, and I called the man that I trusted more than anybody on the planet Earth, Charlie Yao. I said, I don't know that I can go to that town. I've never gotten closure on those ghosts that live in that swamp out there. They're still in my head and still in my bedroom, man. They still haunt me to this day. And Charlie Yao said, Larry, boy, you go to Macomb, Mississippi. You can probably get you some closure. So I called and accepted the invitation and went down there, and our host took us out to the crash site. And I did get the closure that I had hoped for. But when that plane went down that day, Larry Scott's identity went down, because my name was Larry Scott and I worked for Lynyrd Skynyrd Band. That's who I was. So I'm wandering around for the next 3 years trying to find myself. I stayed within that business, working for different promoters and different bands and this and that. And I'd like to tell you I moved to Atlanta in 1980, because I'm homeless at this point. I didn't move to Atlanta. I escaped to Atlanta. I'm sleeping on my brother's couch, and had moved to Atlanta to start a new career. And went to work for a record company there that we'd done some business with. But this is in 1980, and keeping in mind the time frame, I didn't quit until 1987. But by 1980, I was unemployable. Nobody wanted to be around me, because all I was a taker, selfish, self-centered human being all my life, and it really developed in those last 7 years. And they said, you can't be here anymore. I worked for Cycle News Magazine over here at Long Beach, and you had to be an alcoholic just to work there. They told me, said, you can't come around here like that no more, and they fired me. I interviewed good. I just can't hang on to the job. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, that girl that I had been living with off and on for the last 10 years, she came home one day, and I was kind of like Bill when they said that he was 40 pounds underweight and he could eat little or nothing when drinking, which was all the time. That was me, and I was dying. And she came home, and she said, you're dying, Larry, and you can't do that here. You've got to go. September 1987. And you know what I did? You know what I did? Sold out, man, big time. I left with the only thing I owned, and that was a dirty, nasty, stinking clothes on my back. And Larry Scott becomes homeless again. And I'm living in the bush and abandoned cars and abandoned buildings. And I didn't have any friends left, none. Burned every bridge. But I had some acquaintances that would give me what I call a daybed. They said, you can come and you can stay here tonight, but in the morning when we go to work, you got to be gone. You can't be here. And I was at this woman's house. Somebody mentioned Lawrenceville, Georgia earlier. I was in Lawrenceville, Georgia at this woman's house, and her phone rang. And to this day, I have no idea where he got the number or how he found me, but it was my older brother that had found you. I said, hello? He says, I understand you're in really bad shape, and if you don't get some help, we're going to bury you. Cowboy says, nah, dude, I got this. I'm good. But he kept talking. And his message to me was just like that of Ebby to Bill. He kept talking, and his message had depth and weight. Because I thought he was going to try and send me to a treatment center. I've been watching them commercials on television say, if you don't get help at Peachford, get help somewhere. I'm homeless. And he says, write down this number. And he gave me your hotline number. He says, call this number and you can get help. I said, but you don't understand, I'm homeless. He says, you don't have to have any resources, call the number. I showed up in Tucker. I keep looking at my buddy Dick, and there you were, you greeted me. I went in and I don't know who led, who read, don't know what was said. But you told me I didn't have to live this way no more. And all I wanted to do was quit doing that other stuff, that other fortifier that I was doing. I wasn't an alcoholic when I got here. See, I caught it from y'all. It's a highly contagious disease. It enters through the ear. So when it was over with, I went right down the street to Partners 2 liquor store and bought two of the cheapest bottles of champagne they had to celebrate that white chip. Well, it was a long walk from the back. It was humiliating. Well, for the next 90 days, I'd invite you to the house. Let's have a couple of beers and let's talk about this. Y'all are just a little over the top about that. And you looked at me like I had a horn coming out of the middle of my head. And then it's December 31st, 1987, and I got one of them day beds. Because I'm still drinking. I'm still going to your meetings. See, I hook up with everybody in that book, me and Dr. Bob. I get it. Go to your stupid meetings and get drunk every night. But it was progressing on me. I wasn't doing any of that other stuff. I was just drinking. I was drinking heavy. I had a day bed, and this woman, she'd give me a bed for the night. It's New Year's Eve, and I'd started drinking that morning, and she was in the kitchen. And in the South, we do a thing for New Year's Day. It's collard greens and black-eyed peas. It's for good luck. And she was over at the sink cutting up the black-eyed peas, and there was a four-gallon stock pot on the stove with rolling, boiling water with those greens and ham hocks in it. And I'm in a blackout, so what I'm sharing with you is pretty much hearsay. I went over there, and I picked up that pot of boiling water, and I dumped it on this woman's arms. And I took off that belt with the big Western belt buckle. I still relive that every time. And I wrapped it around my hand, and I went through her home, and I destroyed her stuff, her lamps, her TV, all of her electronics. I've got a free bed for a night. Nice guy. Well, Larry Scott's homeless again. An old-timer told me one time, he said, I don't know about you, son, but when I got to AA, I needed recovery about like Custer needed an airstrike. And boy, I needed it. And I didn't need no middle-of-the-road solution. Nobody insulted my intelligence by saying, just don't drink no matter what. Just don't you drink. You just don't drink and go to meetings. Because I don't know what that means. I had no idea what that means. I needed somebody to come at me with a real solution, something that I could hang on to. They needed to give me the chemotherapy that's in here. Because this is the only thing that's going to save my life.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
This is it. And that's what you gave me. Started going to my brother's home group over in Vinings, and it was infested with old-timers. And I'm going to tell you what, my perception early on, they were the meanest form of human being on the planet Earth. I'd go in there on Thursday night, and old Bob Knapp would be in there setting up the chairs and putting out the ashtrays back when you could smoke, making the coffee. And my brother-in-law had given me a job selling cars, which is something I don't suggest early recovery. But he gave me this job, and I can't sell it. I can't give away a car. And I'm on a draw versus commission. They'll give you about $250 a week, but you got to pay it back when you sell a car. Well, I'm in the hole for about $500, $600. So I walk in that meeting. Old Bob be over there doing it. I say, hey, Bob. He says, hey, Larry boy, how you doing? I said, Bob, it's not been a good day. These old sales managers are talking down to me, and they treat me like I'm just a second-rate human being. And I'm working on that draw versus commission, and I'm in the hole of them suckers for about $600. He said, boy, you right on schedule. You exactly where you're supposed to be. Well, I start looking around to see if Bob's got a hearing aid on. And that's the way my little walk with the old timers went. But God, they loved me. We're sitting in a meeting one night, one of the open discussion meetings, and it went around, everybody's talking about their stuff, whatever it was, and it got around to me and old Jack Blaylock, God bless him. He said, "Well, Larry, how's your day going?" I said, "Well, Jack, you know, my day started off kind of rocky, but I took one of y'all's suggestions. I went into the customer lounge, and I just turned it over. By golly, y'all told me I could start my day over anytime I wanted to." He said, "Hot dog." He smoked them Luckies down to a roach. He's a hot dog at turning it over some good stuff. Back when I was in Alabama, I used to write them bad checks. He said, "I turned them over to God." He says, "He turned them over to the sheriff, and he came and locked my ass up." So I'm thinking, what is the deep, significant meaning of this? One morning, it was a Saturday morning. How am I doing? Am I good?
Good.
Saturday morning, I got up, and y'all told me I needed to pray on my knees. Well, I was raised Baptist. Not anymore, but back then I was a Baptist. You said you need to pray on your knees, and I'm thinking Baptists don't pray on their knees. But you need to be on your knees. If you're on your knees, it's impossible to be anything but humble. And I said, "Whatever. I'm willing to do whatever you tell me to do. I just don't want to drink no more. I don't want to dance with that beast no more." So I got up, and I hit my knees that morning. Never forget, it was a beautiful spring morning. First time I ever saw a dogwood tree in my life. Grew up around them, but I'd never seen one. I got on my knees and I started praying, and everything came from right here. And boy, the guilt hit me. And I thought, this ain't okay. I've given birth to a little conscience. So I pulled out this accordion phone list I used to give away. It had about 200 or 300 numbers on them. And the first person I called was that old mean sponsor of mine. He wasn't available. So I started going down the list, and I had all these old mean old-timers on there. And the one woman I got, her name was Jean Graves. And Jean was a real fine Southern lady. And everybody's name was Darling. I called, and Jean loved me. I called, she says, "Hello." I said, "Hey, Jean, it's Larry." "Hey, Darling." I said, "Jean, I got this problem, and I need to talk to you about it." She says, "Tell me about it, baby." I said, "Well, Jean, I got up this morning and I prayed and I was on my knees and my prayers were empty. Everything was coming from my lips. Nothing was coming from my heart. It just had no meaning or feeling." It was a long pause. And she comes back and she says, "Well, darling, pray about it." Why bother? Rocking along, it's 1992, and my sponsor, a flag?
Not for you to wear.
Okay, am I got white stuff on me?
No.
Am I good? Did you blow your nose on this?
Yeah.
Thank you. You got to ask. Y'all are from California. Y'all do some crazy stuff out here. Here, just thump the booger off and wipe your forehead with it. So, it's 1992, and the sponsor I had took a job elsewhere, and my stupid, sick perception, he deserted me. Yeah, and I became sponsored by the biggest damn fool you've ever met in your life. We made the craziest decisions. Did this for a year. This guy's name was Larry Scott. And then, I mean, it was touch and go. It was real dicey in my life at the time. And then one night I went to a speaker meeting, and this real square-looking cat wearing a tie and a coat and glasses and that square hairdo, he came and sat down and he started talking. 5 minutes into his talk, he set a hook on me. I had nothing in common. I'd have never chosen this man. 5 minutes into his talk, he set the hook. And he's the man that you told me that I would meet, that I could tell it all to. This man's name was Bill Sanders. His sponsor, previous sponsor, sitting right here. There's a talk that was given by a guy named Alan McGinnis back in the day. And it's a pamphlet that is in the rack. I don't know if it's here or not, but it's in your meetings. And what it is a transcript of a talk he gave. And somewhere around page 10 or 11, depending on the printing, here's what Alan says during the talk. And this describes Bill and my relationship. He says, "I am personally convinced that every human being, from the cradle to the grave, has a basic search to find at least one other human being before whom he can stand completely naked," N-E-K-K-I-D, naked, "completely stripped of all pretense or defense, and trust that other person not to hurt him. Because you see, this other person has stripped himself naked too. And the promise is that this basic search can begin to end with your very first AA encounter." And what this man did is he came into my life and he placed my hand into the hand of the men of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've been a womanizer all my life. He taught me that these people were people with heartbeats, pulses, feelings, and that they were equal to me. They were not there for my use or abuse. Bill Sanders took me to men's workshops in Florida, Virginia, Ohio, San Diego. He got me involved at the Atlanta Men's Workshop in Atlanta. It's 300 guys, now it's four. They go out there 3 days in the woods, 300 guys. I know, boy, rock on. I'll take two. But he taught me how to love the men. He taught me how to trust the men. And at my first Atlanta Men's Workshop, this is way out in the woods and thousands of acres of a 4-H camp, I'm horrified. I'm standing behind a pine tree, and I'm watching the guys over at the bonfire spiritual meeting. And I'm scheming, man. I got to get out of here. This is very uncomfortable. And I look over this way, and there's another cat just like me hiding behind another pine tree. And I said, I'll be damned. Bill Sanders taught me integrity. He taught me responsibility. Man that just passed away up the road, Kip Collins, taught me commitment. Because I got in touch with the men. There was a 10-year period in my life. I didn't go into a meeting where there were females. I did nothing but men's meetings because that's where I belonged. I didn't have the right to sit in a meeting with a female. Because see, when a female walked into the room, I changed. I got taller. I got this big black fuzzy hair. My voice deepened. But today I can do that. Our home group is We Are Not a Glum Lot. We're a Joe and Charlie style book study. We meet every Thursday night at 8 o'clock at Dunwoody United Methodist Church. And there's approximately 250 people there every Thursday night. It was founded by the women. The women came to me and my partner at the time and said, would you bring this message to the women? We have nothing like this available to us. And I said, I don't know if we can do that because we don't do women's co-ed. So I went to my partner. He said, we need to pray about it. And we did. And we got in touch with some people that we trusted. And they said, absolutely. So we started this meeting 10 years ago. And the very first night, we're sitting up at the desk, getting our stuff together, straightening up the papers. I looked up, and there were six absolutely beautiful women sitting right here. And I went, ugh. So I reached over my left hand, and I touched Christian's knee, and I said, we're in trouble. He goes, we need to pray. So we walked down the hall, and we prayed. And what has happened is we've become extremely protective of our young, especially the women. Because you gals, y'all are bad to hit on them newcomer boys too, I know. We see it all the time. But we're extremely protective of our women. Somewhere in the early 90s, I went to a meeting, and the motive to go to this meeting was purely selfish. I wanted to go see some of the guys that I got sober with, and it's a meeting I didn't frequent. And we went in, and big meeting, and all they talked about was the book, the damn book. And I went, this is a little over the top, don't you think? So I asked this guy, I said, Dante, y'all are a little heavy weighted on this book stuff, aren't you? He said, Larry, has anybody ever taken you through the book, Joe and Charlie style? And I said, no. So, short version of the story, he and some guys gave 6 months of their life and took me and my sponsor family 3 tiers down through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous the way that Joe and Charlie taught it. And at the end of it, it was a Thursday night. I said, guys, thank you for your sacrifice. Thank you for your service. Thank you. And he says, dude, that's not the way this ends. I said, excuse me? He said, you got to carry this yet to others. And here's what I said. I said, I'll get around to that. I'm sorry, that was a Tuesday night. Thursday, my phone rang. Buddy of mine, Rob, called, and he says, I've been taking the message over here to the Triangle, and I can't be there tonight. You need to do it. And I said, yeah, but. And he went. I went, and from that night to this very minute, not 1 week has passed that I haven't been in the front of a room, either at home or somewhere on this planet, carrying the Big Book Comes Alive message. Not 1 week. And I say that, but this is, you know, I'm going to continue to do it at home, but this is my last year out there on the road. I got motorcycles to ride. I'm just saying. I just went for a 1,500-mile ride, and no highways, no watches, no GPSs, no maps. And it came very clear to me that there's a life out there in that saddle. And I've been riding since I was 10, and it's my turn. It's time for some of these young cats to come up and pick up this torch and carry it. But that's another story. I had the honor of getting to know Charlie Parmalee in his final years. He mentored me through a lot of stuff. When my partner of 10 years got married and his life changed, Charlie mentored me into working with Charlie Yao. And when I called him, if you ever talked to Charlie, if you ever heard Joe and Charlie's CDs, Charlie was just an old chicken farmer. And I said, Charlie, I need some help. I've got to change partners, and I don't know how to do that. And Charlie goes, well, Larry, you're going to need to adjust. Yeah. Anyway, he gave me a couple hours on the phone. He told me exactly what to do, and the rest is history. But I've been blessed beyond measure to be asked to be of service in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, to carry this divinely inspired message to so many people in so many places. And our home group is not a discussion meeting. And I don't know about in Southern California. I know in other parts of the world, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is killing its young. Because young people walk in for the first time and they have an opinion about this stuff. You know, you read a paragraph out of the book and they got an attendance sheet on the front desk, but they got an opinion about that. You know what I'm saying? And we're insulting them by saying things like, just don't drink and go to meetings. And my favorite was when Charlie Yao used to say, if your butt falls off, just throw her up in the wheelbarrow and bring her on back up here tomorrow night. See, we've been gifted. We're uniquely qualified to carry the message and the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous to these young people. And why are we doing that? Why not just say, go away, I'm busy? Instead of saying, I had a guy call me 10 minutes before I walked out of my room from Gainesville, Georgia. And he says, I'm dying from, he says, I heard your talk. And he says, I'm dying from the same thing that was killing you. Can you share that with me? I said, Tom, I'll be back in Atlanta Monday evening. You call me. Because I'm uniquely qualified. Ron stood here last night, about 10 minutes into his talk. He set a hook on me. He talked about some stuff that made me extremely uncomfortable. Guess what that means? I got some work to do, man. And I bet if I call Ron, he'll give me some solutions and give me some direction. He'll paint out a picture for me exactly how to go from point A to point B. Betcha. Because that boy was grateful. There's a challenge that I'm going to pose to each and every one of you. When you go back to your home group, get your coffee, sit down, everybody's got your seat, I know you got your seat, go to your seat and sit there with your coffee and close your eyes for 1 hour. Keep your eyes closed and listen. Listen and think to yourself, if a newcomer is in my meeting right here tonight, not in 20 meetings, tonight, right here, right now, is the newcomer going to hear the solution here? I think you're going to be appalled at what you walk away with. Not going to stereotype, because I've been to some badass meetings in Southern California. I got just some people here that motivated me when I got home, man. I started a revolution back in Atlanta. God, these people are busy. Go to your meeting and see if the newcomer can hear the solution in your meeting. Or are we talking about, well, my car wouldn't start this morning. Or I came out of Walmart and there was a shopping cart got away and banged into the side of my car. Really? Yeah, I was out cutting the grass yesterday and that damn weed whacker wouldn't start. New guys over there going, hell, I can go back to the bar and hear about this. We're uniquely qualified to carry this message. And this message is the program of recovery. Fifth tradition, man. Because there's so many people that need us. I mean, there are people that are just like us out there dying. And we're playing with them. And how am I doing here? About time?
You got plenty of time.
Yeah?
Yes, sir.
Y'all want to take a nap? It's like, I'm going to give you an example of something. I'm pretty visual. If I were to come down off the podium right now and take a little pistol out of my pocket and walk down here to my little friend and pop a load in her right foot, just play along. If I did that, she has a couple of choices. Kathy could go to the Hawaiian shirt and say, is there a medicine kit in here anywhere with a Band-Aid and some methylate? She could do that. Or she could jump on the back of Rex's motorcycle and get him to rush her over to the medical center and have them remove that bullet, clean up the wound, do any bone repair that needed to be done, pop her in the butt with some penicillin or whatever to kill the infection, sew it up, and recover from that. Or she could put the Band-Aid methylate on it and just be recovering. I think I know what her choice would be. And what we've got is we've got a fatal wound in us right now. And our book promises us 30-some-odd times that we do recover. If all you'd promised me when I got here was that I was going to be recovering, I don't know that I would have stayed. But the greatest promise that you gave me on the very first page of the book is, here's a story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered. Jump in, do what we did, and you can get what we got. Bill Wilson said in a letter he wrote in 1966, and I've got it, but I'm not going to read it to you. He just said, basically, if AA ever collapses, it'll be at the hand of the fellowship. Because you see, this is perfect. This is perfect. It's not been touched since 1939. The fellowship is what's flawed. And if we can align us with this, we got a better shot of staying above board. Dr. Bob said, and Dr. Bob and the good old timers, he said, you know, these steps are real simple. They're plain in language, and they don't need any special interpretation. Like Doc Crandall used to say, I called him one day, I said, here's the way I interpret this. He says, boy, these steps don't need your interpreting. They just need your doing. See, it's perfect. It ain't broke. It don't need my fixing. Walked into my brother's office, the one that 12-stepped me. He gave me a job back in the day, and I was sitting there at his desk, and he's got the big chair, and I'm shuffling papers for him for minimum wage. And I walked in. I had a good idea. I said, let me tell you how I think you can grow your business. He says, stop right there, Hoss. He says, just remember which chair you're sitting in. I don't have a better idea. This ain't broke. It doesn't need my fixing. It just needs my doing. There's a guy that used to live out here, Johnny Siegel. Many of you may have known him. I hosted Johnny at an international conference one year. I was sitting in the front row, and I know he wasn't talking directly to me, but he spoke into the guts of my soul. He says, our fellowship is made up of two kinds of people. There's players and there's fans. The players show up, the Hawaiian shirt, my boy Tim, my boy John, all these cats sitting up here, hundreds and a multitude of people on a committee that brought this together. There's your players. Those are the people we applaud. And then we got the fans. Players give the rides and set up stuff, and they're active. Doing one of these gigs, hell, just chairing a meeting is not an easy gig. Sacrifice, man. And 12th step work, no matter what you call it, it ain't convenient, and it all ain't always glamorous. Johnny said the players are the ones that make all this happen. They're the doers. And then you got the fans. They take the free coffee, steal the books, take the rides. They leave before the end in prayer. And at that moment, he looked at me and says, "What's your choice going to be?" In 1996, I said, "I'll never, ever be a fan again. I'm in." It's events like this and going to Founders Day, and we do a sober cruise back home, that teach our young that there's fun in this gig, man. Because if this ain't fun, I'm out. I'm out. I know where to go have some fun. It may not last long, but I know where to go. But you've given me a way of life that's indescribably wonderful, more wonderful than anything I've ever known. I remember who I was with and what we did. Go to a lot of rock and roll shows, man, and I can tell you everything they played. Hot dog. You know, there's fun in recovery. The fellowship has always been there for me. I know I'm sweating like a preacher in a crap game up here. Y'all ever go to McDonald's and get that hamburger that's been sitting up there under them lights for about an hour? And you've been with me through death, divorce, bankruptcy. You've been with me through all of it. And not once did you say, "You're going to get through this, Larry." You know what you say? You say, "We're going to get through this." And we always have. In 2001, the man that 12-stepped me, that placed my hand into your hand, I got a phone call from his partner of 37 years. And his partner says, "Larry, your brother's had a stroke. It's not good. You need to come now." And he was 60-something miles away. And I showed up over at the hospital, Tanner Medical Center. Walked in, and my brother had tubes and monitors, and it was ugly. Before I got there, you were there. You were there waiting on me. When me and my family arrived, you grabbed us and you held us and you cried with us and you prayed with us and you hung on to us until the decision was made that it was just a better idea to let him cross over. And they took us to the graveyard that day. I got out of the car and I looked, and guess who was there? Y'all were there. And my sponsor was standing there by the hole waiting on me. And you held me and you prayed with me. And you took care of me and my family through one of the darkest days of my life. When Charlie Yao died January the 23rd, I don't know that I'll ever get past that. Kip Collins called me and he says, "I need you to hear firsthand. I got lung cancer and it ain't good." Pretty dark day. But guess what? You were there. You've always been there. You've never let me down. You've always had me. You've had more than my back. Because my back has sometimes not been strong enough and you've carried me. It's the greatest little club I've ever been a part of. You taught me that if I sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, that my life would improve. It would constantly improve. And 20 years ago, some people taught me a methodology of praying, because I've been a seeker. I walked away from that Baptist teaching, and I slipped into some other disciplines that felt more comfortable. And I finally landed with my heritage, which is Cherokee. But during the seeking process, every Thursday night at 7:30, a group of people at my home group, we slide off in this little room and we hold hands and we pray. Now, are we all like-minded with this? Yeah. But I've never once asked them, "Who are you praying to? What are you praying to? What are you?" I don't care. None of my business. But here's what I know. I know that God is alive and well in their life because I see it manifested. A couple of years ago, I was in Iceland with Chris Raymer, and I did an 11-step workshop on Saturday, and this huge monster of a guy, Jan Lufkin. He's a great big guy. All the guys over there look like Vikings. They look like they should be eating a cow leg. He comes up to me, and Jan's like this. He's as tall as Ron. Bigger, but tall. He says, could I come to your room and pray with you in the morning? I said, yeah, that'd be fine. So at 8 o'clock the next morning, he comes and he knocks on the hotel room door. And I let him in. In my broken English, I tried to explain to him what we were going to do. His broken English, he tried to understand. And we held hands. We'd knee to knee. And I did this little opening thing, and then I prayed. I put out my request to God, Creator. I squeezed his hands for him to pray. And he started praying, because over there, their language is Icelandic, whatever that is. And he started praying in English. And about 10 seconds into it, he was stumbling terribly. He started jerking me, and I'm flailing all over. I said, what, dude? He says, I must meet God in my tongue. I said, rock on. This man started praying to the God of his understanding in a tongue that was familiar to him. All of a sudden, I felt the moisture dripping off my beard. And I was in the presence of a God that I didn't understand. But I followed Jan and his wife's life. They live in Akureyri, just north of Reykjavik. And I don't know who Jan prayed to that day. But here's what I know. The God of his understanding is alive and well in his life. I see it every day because we stay in touch. And wrapping this thing up, my prayer life is very important to me. And all you cats that ride, I know y'all know about praying and riding and riding and praying. Y'all got some great areas, little prayer parlors all over these hills. When I pray, I get one of four answers. The first answer I get is yes, and I love that answer. I think we all do. And the second answer I get is no. I'm not crazy about it, but I can live with it. The third answer that I hate is not right now. Because I'm a good alcoholic. I want what I want, and I want it now. And the fourth answer I get is I cannot believe you prayed that shit. South Bay Roundup. Man, you guys are great. Can't thank you enough for having me. And I met some native friends here. And for those of you that don't know what this means, Metakue Oyasin means we're all related. We're all relations. You're all my relations. And hope our paths cross again down the road. Thanks.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.